negotiating anything with the North Koreans takes a very long time.
Keeping North Korea on the denuclearization track. It's Tuesday, July 3rd. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, Chinese consumers are choosing domestic over imports, compensating for child abuse, rising to new freedoms in Afghanistan, using a disease to treat cancer, and protecting kids on tech. It's all on today's VOA Asia. A number of experts are questioning the timetable and willingness of North Korea to cooperate with its pledge to denuclearize following last month's historic summit in Singapore between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Satellite imagery indicates the North is completing a major expansion of a key missile manufacturing plant. And the website 38 North said Pyongyang is upgrading its Yongbyon nuclear complex. NBC News is quoting U.S. officials as saying the North has increased production of fuel for nuclear weapons, while the Washington Post reported that U.S. intelligence officials do not believe the North intends to give up its nuclear arsenal. Joshua Pollack, a senior research associate at the Middlebury Institute for International Studies, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, theoretically, a lot of work can be done in a year's time, but the hard part will be the politics of disarmament.
Negotiating anything with the North Koreans takes a very long time. For example, the six-party talks, which was in the 2000s, opened in mid-2003, and the first agreement with real commitments in it took about 2 years to arrive. The first agreement on how to implement those commitments took another roughly 2 years. It simply seems to me that the pace of diplomacy with the North Koreans is never that quick. And while bulldozers and container ships and whatever else you could imagine can certainly do a lot of work in that time, the path won't be open for that, politically speaking, quite so quickly. And I think talking about a year, 1 year, is setting unrealistic expectations.
So U.S. intelligence apparently is not certain exactly how many nuclear warheads that the North has. The Defense Intelligence Agency says it may be as high of about 50. Obviously, the number will involve time to get rid of them.
Yes, I don't think that the North Koreans will ever let us know exactly how many they have or really plan to give them up. They have given a declaration of past fissile material production more than once, and I think that they are determined not to show their hand fully. They are interested, I think, in lowering the profile of their nuclear program, but they will not give the whole thing up. It's too important to them as a means of security against a vastly more powerful opponent. Having said that, there are precedents for understanding and trying to verify past fissile material production, that is plutonium and highly enriched uranium that you would put in weapons. And becoming confident of what a state tells you takes years. There's a long process of examining the records, examining records forensically to make sure they haven't been falsified, visiting facilities, taking samples, checking the samples against the declarations, trying to figure out how much has gone missing because of industrial processes and how much might have been diverted. This is not simple. So again, logistics and earth moving is easy enough. It's quick enough. But this larger process of verification is much tougher. Not that I imagine it will really come into play in this case. The trust between the two sides is persistently low. And while the North Koreans may give up some facilities to us as a goodwill gesture, I do not believe they will ever give up their nuclear weapons.
Joshua Pollack said in the wake of last month's Singapore summit, the United States can insist on an all-or-nothing approach or accept progress that makes the U.S. and its allies more secure but doesn't solve all the problems. That would mean adopting the North Korean approach of action for action or an incremental progress that, he said, would likely to be lengthy and only go so far and fall short of complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find currently trending on voanews.com. Local governor says missing boys and coach found alive in flooded Thailand cave. China downplays exclusion from U.S.-led naval exercises. UN chief says unimaginable stories of killings and rape from Rohingya refugee camps. HRW says Indonesia's unlawful action contributes to soaring HIV rate. Thailand's political tough guy back in the fray to support military as a vote nears. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. A new survey finds a growing appetite among China's burgeoning middle class for so-called fast-moving consumer goods, like shampoo and soft drinks, with a growing number preferring domestic to foreign brands, and that's a potential trouble sign for U.S. firms doing business in China. These are among the findings of the seventh and latest annual China Shopper Report issued by the Bain & Company Management Consultancy in concert with Cantor World Panel, a global expert on shoppers' behavior. Bain partner Bruno Land said for the first time since the survey was taken in 2012, sales of such goods in 2017 surpassed the previous year's growth, advancing over 4%, a sign, he said, Chinese consumers are living healthier, more enjoyable lives. Land spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty from his office in Shanghai.
It is really around consumers being more sophisticated, having higher income and therefore more discretionary spending. Just on that point, as you know, average income per capita in China increased by 8% per year for the last 5 years. And so that clearly translates into more discretionary income to spend. There is also a desire to improve lifestyle. There is a desire to have better products, take care of health and wellness, indulge yourself into leisure activities. And so this is what you would expect from a middle class that is now, you know, away or out of their needs for daily necessities and really looking to buy more for their own, you know, pleasure, lifestyle, and entertainment. So that's what we're seeing. And that's a very positive sign, of course, for China and for everybody doing business in China.
Well, what kind of products are they going for now?
So the typical products would be, in every sector, it would be the premium range. So if I take beer as an example, beer, there are, low-end beers, just like in every market, mostly local brands would operate at that level. And then, of course, premium and imported brands would be there as well. And clearly you see that the low-end beer are declining, but the premium beer brands are actually increasing and improving. You could also look at categories like pet food, which is clear, which is double-digit growth as well. This is clearly a sign of a lifestyle type of spending, of course. You could think of cosmetics, skincare, as well as color cosmetics and makeup. All of these going double digits, so this is also a sign of sophistication and health and wellness, if you will. So this is both on categories, but even within categories, we see the premium segment in those categories growing much faster.
Bruno, is this primarily confined to major urban areas, or is this filtering out to the countryside or to smaller cities?
It's urban China only. However, it does cover tier 1 to tier 5 cities. So the trend for tier 5 versus tier 1, in fact, we don't see too much differences between tier 1 to tier 5. I think it's urbanization at full swing in China. What we see, though, is more differences by provincial geographies. You see the western and the southwest provinces going faster, the east coast provinces, not just cities, but provinces, growing much smaller rates.
This is a fascinating aspect of this, and that is for a sixth year, you say, local brands are winning out against foreign brands. Why is that?
This is an amazing story, and I'm glad we started to track this 6 years ago, because we did not expect it would become such a big story and a repeating story. The local brands, on an aggregate basis, for 26 categories that we track between home care, personal care, food and beverage, When you look at the aggregate share of local brands versus the aggregate share of multinational brands, we see that local brands grew by nearly 8% last year, 2017, whereas the multinational brands grew by less than 1%, 0.5%. We believe that the local brands are just moving much faster and they are a lot more innovative. And the two together is becoming a very important and critical competitive advantage, because the China market is moving very, very fast and evolving very fast. So if we continue to introduce products which, number one, could be sourced from, you know, global R&D centers, and number two, you introduce at the pace which was the normal pace, you know, 5 years ago, then you cannot win against the Chinese, because they would introduce, first of all, customized and locally developed products for the China market, and second, they will introduce them much faster because they have all their decision centers in China. They can move quickly. Another aspect of this, of course, is many of those local companies are still run by their founders. And so just like any entrepreneurs in any part of the world, you know, entrepreneurs typically move much faster. They don't have to justify decisions, back and forth, you know, discussions and committees. They just decide and move on. And so I think that is, in this changing market, becoming a critical competitive advantage.
Bruno Land said while he believes a low-level tariff dispute between the United States and China will not have an immediate impact on sales of U.S. products in China, there is a history to Chinese consumer backlash. He pointed to South Korea's deployment last year of a U.S.-made anti-missile network amid tensions with North Korea. He said Chinese consumers took their cue from the central government's alarm by THAAD and reduced both spending on South Korean products and tourism to the country. Happening now in Asia, 12 teenage soccer players and their adult coach who have been trapped in a flooded Thailand cave for 9 days have been found safe, according to the governor of Chiang Rai province. A team of elite Thai Navy divers announced they had reached a critical passage in the flooded cave complex. You're always up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to be with you today on VOA Asia. A multi-billion dollar compensation scheme for victims of child abuse has begun this week in Australia. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports financial restitution was one of the key recommendations of a five-year royal commission into the abuse of children in Australian institutions that date back several decades.
Authorities believe the $3 billion scheme will help to ease the pain of those who were abused in Australian institutions. Michael Welsh, an Aboriginal man, was forcibly taken from his parents when he was 8 years old. He was sent to the notorious Kinchella Boys' Home in New South Wales State, where he says he was brutally mistreated.
We were starved, we were flogged, and we were abused physically and sexually.
It's estimated that 60,000 Australians will be eligible to claim compensation, but victims of child abuse who have criminal records might not be allowed to take part. The average claim is likely to be around $56,000, and payments are capped at $110,000. Michael Welsh hopes to buy land and be surrounded by his family.
I'd love to have a property so they could build their own houses on or whatever. Yeah, that's my dream.
Australia's Minister for Social Services, Dan Tehan, says the compensation scheme is a significant step forward.
This is momentous for those who suffered child sex abuse. For years and years, they have sought redress, they have sought an apology, they have sought compensation. And on 1 July, that process will begin.
The multi-billion dollar redress scheme was a key recommendation of a royal commission that investigated child sexual abuse in Australian religious organisations, schools, charities, sports clubs and the military. For 5 years, the inquiry heard stories of depravity, of children being routinely attacked and degraded. Many perpetrators held positions of leadership and authority, including priests and teachers. The commission published its report last December. The government says most of its recommendations will be implemented, and the Prime Minister will make a national apology to victims of abuse in October. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, soaring to new heights in Afghanistan. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia. Human Rights Watch says Indonesia's anti-LGBT crackdown is causing people at risk of HIV to avoid seeking treatment, fueling a health crisis. A newly released 70-page report available online documents how the unlawful activities have impacted the lives of Indonesia's sexual and gender minorities. We document the day's latest developments on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, since the fall of the Taliban regime in 2001, women in Afghanistan have broken many taboos in the ultra-conservative, male-dominated society. Sport is just one of the fields which women are now actively participating in. VOA's Hedayatullah Noori recently spoke with the country's first female paraglider and her fellow teammates. Behshan Hamdard narrates.
Lida Huzuri, Afghanistan's first female paraglider, preparing to take flight. Her first jump was just 6 years ago, when she managed to find the courage to leap from a 300-meter-tall mountain.
We have had a lot of problems, but this year we were able to establish our paragliding federation. I myself have been paragliding for 6 years, and in these 6 years, we have been able to learn paragliding as much as we had hoped.
Huzuri says successful paragliding depends on many factors, from changing weather patterns, the direction of wind, the shape of clouds, to temperature and terrain.
I have had very good experiences, and one of those experiences that I really enjoyed was my very first flight, which resulted in me continuing paragliding to this day.
Since the fall of the Taliban, Huzuri says there have been many more opportunities for women.
Women's participation in sports in Afghanistan has increased, and paragliding is a really good sport. My message to all young girls who are interested is come and become a member in our federation and fly with us.
Afghanistan's paragliding team has more than 120 members, but only 20 are women. Nawit Popal, an early pioneer of the sport in the country, says they practice in Kabul and surrounding provinces.
We practice paragliding 2 or 3 times a week, and sometimes 4 or 5 times a week. If we travel to other provinces, we practice it during our stay. Here in Kabul, due to financial and other problems, it is difficult to practice every day.
To succeed, paragliders must have a strong passion for the sport. Popal is counting on team members like Huzuri to inspire her fellow paragliders as the team prepares for their next competition against the best jumpers in the world. For Hidayatullah Noori in Kabul, this is Behshan Hamdard, VOA News.
This news from VOA Asia. 23 people have been arrested in India after 5 men were beaten to death by an enraged mob, sparked by false rumors spread on smartphones of child kidnapping. Police said the attack began after locals spotted one of the 8 talking to a child after they disembarked from a bus. Visit the VOA Asia Facebook for more. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, there's an exciting new breakthrough in treating deadly brain tumors. Doctors have used a modified polio virus to treat people with brain cancer. VOA's Carol Pearson reports the results so far are promising.
How many fingers? 3. How many? 2.
Stephanie Hopper is having a standard neurological test. She was diagnosed with glioblastoma, an aggressive brain cancer, 8 years ago. Surgeons removed the tumor, but it returned 2 years later. The survival rate for glioblastoma is low, at best 1.5 years after diagnosis. Hopper entered a study that uses a genetically modified poliovirus developed at Duke Cancer Institute. The modified virus doesn't cause paralysis, but it does shrink the tumor. A clinical trial showed that the treatment significantly improved long-term survival for patients whose glioblastoma had returned. The 3-year survival rate was 21% for these patients, while only 4% of patients with the same type of recurring brain tumors were alive 3 years after having what was then the standard treatment. Even a dead poliovirus causes a very strong immune response. The dead virus is used in the polio vaccine. At Duke University Medical Center, researchers wanted that strong immune response, but without any chance of getting polio, so they modified the virus. Dr. Daryl Bigner is the senior author of the study.
What this did, very simply, was to destroy the ability of the poliovirus to infect nerve cells and cause poliomyelitis any longer, but it retained the ability to kill cancer cells.
Doctors injected the modified virus directly into the brain. They repeated the treatment on 5 patients whose cancer returned.
Those that we've been able to follow long enough have responded to the treatment the second time.
The procedure is still experimental, but the results are so promising that doctors have started a second study combining the poliovirus with chemotherapy to try to improve the results. As for Stephanie Hopper, her tumor continues to shrink. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
Parents often have to play catch-up with the fast pace of technology, and it's often difficult to really know what their children are doing on their electronic devices. Maybe they're hearing VOA's Mariama Diallo tell us more.
What about Jasmine?
Despite monitoring apps and restrictions placed on phones, parents are finding it hard to keep up with their kids. Jania Bivens has a 13-year-old daughter, Ariel.
You can't be everywhere all the time.
Bivens says the technology designed to keep children safe online is not infallible because after she blocked Twitter on her daughter's phone, the 13-year-old found another way and got a message from a stranger.
This guy asked to see my feet, and I was like, what?
When you give your child this ominous device, it's like giving them the keys to your brand new Cadillac.
Richard Wistoki is a retired police detective who specializes in cyber crimes. He says parents trust their children too much and are victims of what he calls the NMK syndrome.
Not my kid. My kid would never do that.
Yet young children can now chat with strangers on apps like WhatsApp, House Party, and Musical.ly. One parent had no idea her 13-year-old daughter was messaging with an unknown boy on Snapchat until an older daughter alerted her.
As parents, we need to wake up. No doubt.
Nathan Hale Elementary School principal Don Iles Gomez says her school requires students to leave their phones in the homeroom throughout the day.
I cannot even imagine how much is going on that we have no clue. And I'm saying that as someone who works with kids and is decent with technology.
But even being decent with technology isn't enough. Experts say kids find all kinds of sneaky ways of using their phones right under their parents' noses.
Why does it come up like that?
And as one mother put it, just monitoring their social media presence is a full-time job in addition to the day-to-day parenting.
Who's that?
Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Smartphones, of course, are a great way to hear our program. Just find us on the VOA app and listen to VOA Asia when we come on the air. Or you can find us on our website, voanews.com, and download our program as a podcast. Stream us on VOA Asia Facebook. Or how about listen to us on the radio? If you happen to be in Tainan, Taiwan, you can hear us on the voice of Chungrung, Star Radio FM 88.3 at Chungrung Christian University. Of course, Tainan, Taiwan. We thank everyone there who is tuned in today. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zainab Abdel-Rahman, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, including Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a super day.